You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on July 29th, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Persephone and I discuss a big idea. Can government programs be measured objectively, or is it inherently political? Then we talk about Western arms sales to the world and the crisis in Libya. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio is Persephone. Persephone, welcome back to America.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
The first topic that we're going to be looking at today is about the issue of measuring government performance. This is our next kind of big idea in American reform topic. And there was an article in one of the New York Times blogs by David Leonhard, and he was kind of looking at what areas of the government don't have a lot of measurement going on, but also more importantly, that there's a big trend in introducing it. And of course, part of the thing that gets pointed out is that the private sector's been doing this for quite a bit longer in most cases, and many government programs are not being measured at all. And a lot of people are saying, well, obviously we need to bring that so-called big data revolution into the government. And I think that there's definitely some merit to that. It's a little bit harder for the government to move kind of nimbly toward these best practices in the way that the private sector can, in large part because the government is dependent on election cycles and somebody has to kind of make that a priority. And so far, that hasn't really happened. So, you know, for every 2 years or 4 years that it's not made a priority, it continues to not be a priority. However, Nate and I, a few weeks back, had been talking about the Veterans Affairs scandal. And one of the things that we brought up in that was that the scandal exists because of the data measuring. That was one of the areas, the VA is one of the areas where government has been measuring performance of programs longer than anywhere else. And the fact that they were attempting to measure it is how they discovered that A, some people weren't getting care as fast as they were supposed to be, and B, that there were sort of cover-ups about how fast people were getting care. So my kind of broad-based perspective on this is that measuring government performance is important, but it really depends on the details of how that's done and who does it. What was your sort of macro take on this, Persephone?
Well, I mean, the first example of this whole dynamic that comes to mind is, of course, No Child Left Behind, and how we measure public schools and the results of those measurements on school funding. But I think that more generally speaking, it's important to know how programs work and how they don't work, and to have some idea of where we need to work on things. But at the same time, if the result is just going to be cutting funding, then that isn't necessarily going to help anybody, because the government is not a business. The government shouldn't operate exactly like a business. It's something that's there to provide services to people. But it's not some sort of supply and demand situation where, you know, people are buying products. The government is there to provide services for people, yes, based on need, but not necessarily based on the same principles that we would apply to a business.
Right. I think that's a really important point to remember, and one that also raises concerns for me, which is the performance that's being measured about effectiveness of delivery of services, or is it being measured on the cost effectiveness or the profitability, so to speak, of these things? Because, as you said, some of these programs are not meant to be profitable, nor can they be. And that's why they are in the government as opposed to the private sector. That's the biggest red flag for me, I would say, with these measuring things. One of the things that I like to point out is that with this big data revolution, as it's called, the perspective seems to be, oh, well, the measurement is objective, and then what you do with that is subjective. And I don't think that's correct. I think that measuring things is also subjective in its own way, because you have to make a decision about what you're measuring, how you're measuring it, and what you're going to do with that measurement. And if you don't measure certain things and you do measure other things, that's a subjective decision that you've made to say, well, we're going to ignore this and not measure it, or we are going to measure this other thing. And sometimes that can be, you know, misguided reasons for leaving things out, but sometimes it can be misguided reasons for bringing things in on those measurements. Now, this has sort of been kind of an ongoing debate for, as much as the trend seems to be portrayed that this is something just since the 90s with all the access to data and everything, and that's true to some extent, this is something that's been going on for much of the U.S.'s history, particularly in the 20th century. I think it especially becomes important, arguably, after the creation of the income tax and things like that in the, 1913 or so. And one of the really big changes that happened was the kind of creation of GDP or GNP, gross national product, gross domestic product, as a sort of concept. That was a way of measuring that originally was conceived to help kind of measure the ability to go to war, like the preparedness for war, measuring kind of how much available manufacturing do you have going on and things like that. And that's important. It's good that we have a way of measuring our economy, but as has long been pointed out for decades now, GDP has a lot of problems as a measurement system. It's not an objective measurement system. It's a specific decision to say, well, we're going to count these things in the measurement, but we're not going to count these things. And it also tends to, you know, if you talk to the environmental movement, they don't really like GDP because it measures, it weighs equally, oh, I'm going to make this thing that's terrible for the environment and has all these disastrous environmental consequences and externalities. I'm going to say this is this amount of thing. And then, oh, it also is going to be this to clean it up. And that's, well, here's plus 10 units of GDP and plus 10 more units of GDP, as opposed to having some sort of nuanced thing that says, well, this is actually a net harm to the economy and society, even if they kind of require the same expenditures, essentially. So that's sort of a problem when you get into the issue of measuring things.
And also, I mean, the GDP sometimes gets used to say, oh, look how wealthy this country is, without taking into account, of course, you know, the huge gap between the rich and the poor. You can have a very high GDP and still have a huge amount of people living in dire poverty.
Right. And just to give some other examples of how easily these things can be manipulated, China recently, it was recalibrated. Not China didn't recalibrate anything. This was sort of the IMF and the World Bank and all those different things. They all have their own different way of measuring GDP and also GDP adjusted for purchasing power and kind of different income levels and things like that. And one of the organizations adjusted, and overnight that meant that China was ranked as the number one economy instead of the number two economy. Nothing changed in China fundamentally. It was a question of how they measured it. This was the purchasing power one, so they had to adjust for the fact that a lot of people had moved from the rural areas where the cost of living was lower to these sort of more middle-class urban areas in these new cities. And that's a change that's been going on for a while, but they didn't update the statistics externally. So that kind of goes to show that the idea that this is an objective way of measuring things is not really reality. Similarly, in the United States, the U.S. government changed the definition of unemployment in about 1993 or so, right? There was a recession, and then they said, oh, well, actually, if you're not looking for work anymore, or if you're partly employed but not fully employed, you no longer count as unemployed. So again, overnight, the unemployment drops, and it's like, yay, we got rid of unemployment. But in reality, you had a lot of people who were severely underemployed for 10, 15, 20 years between the 92 recession, the 2001 recession, and the 2007 recession. So that didn't really help those people. And that's where this gets to be a problem. It's not an abstraction that it's hard to measure these things or that the definitions matter. It really does affect people's lives. Because if you say, well, I can only get 10 hours of work a week, but I don't count as unemployed, but I also can't feed my family, you know, and that goes on for 15 years, they're not going to recognize as easily, oh, you need a lot more help. And that sort of U6 unemployment rate, which is the name for the one that's more comprehensive, that includes the chronically underemployed people and the people who stopped looking for work, that tended to be around the same levels as, say, Spain or France or some of the other countries in the European Union, the ones that were specifically being derided for many years as somehow having a much worse labor problem than the United States, when in fact, you know, if you measured the unemployment differently in the United States, it came out to be about the same. So that was basically 10 years of false congratulations to the United States.
And that ties right into all the myths that we tell ourselves here in the U.S. about this idea that the competitive nature of the economy means that it's better for everybody. When in reality, it's certainly better for some people, but there are plenty of people that are still suffering, and it's not necessarily places that have a more, that have a larger safety net also manage to solve some of these problems that we don't even notice because of the faulty way that we measure things.
You know, again, I think that we both agree that it would be important to measure some of these programs. It's just a question of who's deciding how the things are measured, what goes into those measurements, and what are we doing with that information afterwards. There were some quotes in the Leonhardt article of the 11 large programs for low and moderate income people that have been subject to rigorous randomized evaluation. Only one or two show strong evidence of improving most beneficiaries' lives. And that right there is portrayed as sort of an objective statement of, look, out of these 11 programs, only one or two are improving lives, and therefore this shows that the other programs aren't effective. But that right there gets into a subjective question, and I don't know the programs that are being referred to here, but are the programs designed to lift up people's standards of living or incomes and things like that? Is the goal of the programs to improve things for people, or is the goal of the programs in question to be a backstop, to establish a floor and keep people from falling below that? The kind of analogy that I came up with is not great, but it works, I guess, for this, is it'd be like walking into a multi-story building and saying, well, the lobby outside the elevator is not lifting me up. And it's like, well, okay, but the elevator's goal is to lift you up. The lobby floor is not meant to lift you up. The lobby floor is to keep you from falling into the basement when you walk through the front door of this building. And that's not a decision to be made by the people who come up with the measurement system or these, you know, statistical analysis people. That's a job for Congress or the president or whoever our leaders are that we've elected to say, on a normative basis, either we want our programs to keep people from falling backward or we want them to lift people up. That's a policy debate to have. That's a political dispute. That's not a question, immediately a question of, is this program working or not? Now, if it's in fact the case that the program is intended to lift people up, then obviously, yes, it's necessary to make some changes to the program to do that. But those are the kind of questions that I kind of want to get people to start thinking about.
Yeah, I think that it's just a question of, you have to ask the question, first of all, would things be better off if this program did not exist, or would things be worse off? And then you have to quite simply ask, is there a way to make this program even more effective? And I think it's really, those are just the questions you need to be asking. You don't need to say, this program isn't helping people the way we want it. I mean, isn't helping people enough. If the destruction of this program, if it's the best program you have and the destruction of the program would actively make things worse, then you want to keep that program.
A lot of the war on poverty programs have been specifically criticized for not ending poverty or whatever. But in a lot of cases, if you include the kind of the value that people receive through those programs, especially before the, you know, welfare reforms and things, you count those cash transfers and stuff. Yeah, people actually were lifted out of poverty, not by a lot, and it maybe didn't help them fully escape the cycle, but it helped them get out of that kind of abject poverty situation where they were just on the absolute brink the whole time. It's not nearly mentioned enough that in the 1960s, large areas of Appalachia still weren't even electrified at that point. And that was the kind of thing that the sort of low baseline that we were working off of. And in light of that, you know, these programs have done pretty well of keep, you know, of raising that kind of baseline to an acceptable or more acceptable level. It's still not great, but it's a lot better. The programs weren't necessarily intended to fix everything or, you know, make all the problems go away. It was just sort of an interim measure. And then they were kind of gradually gutted through the Reagan Revolution and things like that. Another thing that comes up in this article is that one of the people that was kind of criticizing the government approach says that the government has largely ignored the Moneyball revolution, in which private sector decisions are increasingly based on hard data. And of course, that's a reference to the, you know, the thing in baseball where they started using statistics to figure out who was a kind of a player who had some particular strength but wasn't necessarily very highly paid already. So you could, you know, a team could buy them, you know, their contract for a low amount, and then use their specific skill to kind of round out a team rather than just going for the star power that didn't necessarily perform. The thing is, the private sector doesn't actually operate that way a lot of the time, especially in the past 20 or so years, I mean, that's something we've talked about with the private equity approach, you know, taken by Bain Capital and Mitt Romney and people like that. If it were like the baseball situation, they would say, oh, look, this company has an underperforming asset. Let's build that asset up and make it work better so it will make more money. The Mitt Romney approach was to say, how much money can we get from selling off the pieces from this asset because it's not doing anything? And again, maybe that's a legitimate decision for the private sector to make. You know, I don't know, because it depends on a case-by-case basis. Sometimes you just got to say, look, this is not working. We got to unload this piece of the company or something, right? That's sometimes the case, even if you're not being a Mitt Romney type. But sometimes it's not well-motivated. But either way, the government's not supposed to be making decisions like that. The government doesn't get to say, oh, well, this is an underperforming asset that we're going to sell off for parts, because that's not really the goal. The goal is to provide a social good and to help people specifically like that. So that's another thing to worry about. As Persephone had said earlier, it's what's going to be done with the information about these programs. Is the funding going to be cut? Is the program going to be cut entirely? Is the program going to be improved? Who gets to decide what constitutes improvement? That sort of thing raises a lot of red flags for me, as I said at the beginning. So that's another thing to take into consideration when you're deciding about these measurement things. Again, I think that a lot of these programs would benefit from having more measurement into effectiveness so that they can deliver services even more effectively than they already are and continue to help more people wherever possible. But it's not just a matter of turning this over to the stats geeks that are in the such and such branch of government, right? Part of this is going to come down to having a political debate about what we want these programs to do for us. Now, another angle that has been deployed to try to bring in this data aspect, not really so much at the federal government, although it's kind of being proposed as a test there, but more on the state and local governments, is this idea of kind of integrating the private sector into the approach to incentivize meeting these statistical targets and things like that. Now, obviously, the kind of biggest example that we see of this is the pure cost analysis ones, where, you know, the state of Florida, for example, they privatize the prison system, and if the savings aren't above 7%, then they go back to public or whatever, and that's led to all sorts of abuses. And that's a pretty deleterious example, and probably more on the extreme end, although it's a problem, but it's sort of a problem for a separate segment, I think. But that's sort of a pure cost-based analysis. There are some programs that try to analyze something else, even ones that are related to the prison system. This seems to be one of the most popular examples of bringing this in, has to do with the prison system. But instead of saying privatize the prison system, you kind of privatize outcomes in a way. And the example that I wanted to look at was the one in Massachusetts, where the legislature was issuing, these are called social impact bonds, I guess. So basically, Goldman Sachs was going to pay for this certain amount of money. And this was going to go toward funding a program that was supposed to help prevent people from bouncing back into jail, essentially young offenders. And the goal is to reduce recidivism. And so the idea was that it's supposed to be a naturally reinforcing incentive system. So rather than some arbitrary target of 7% cost savings, it was supposed to be the idea is that for every person that doesn't go to prison, that saves the state money on the prison side. And that money, some of that money can be used to invest in these programs that help keep them out of prison and keep them, you know, help them get jobs and things like that. And the way that they brought Goldman Sachs in on this was essentially to say that Goldman Sachs would put up the money up front rather than the state putting up the money up front. And then any of the initial savings would go back to Goldman Sachs rather than the state. And then any, you know, above that, a certain percentage of the savings would go to Goldman Sachs. If the program was super duper successful, then Goldman Sachs would get a huge chunk of it, but the state would also get some of it. Persephone, you had a lot of problems with this program in the role of the government here versus the role of the private sector.
Well, I mean, the first question that comes to mind is, why can't the state do this themselves? Do they really need Goldman Sachs to do this, or could you simply use some public funding to create the same sort of program? It seems like Goldman Sachs' real role in this equation is to provide a little bit of money, which the government can do, the state government, and then to take money back, which ends up taking money from the government because it's based on these supposed savings from the program.
Right. If the government did it by itself, 100% of the savings from keeping people out of prison could be reinvested into these programs to make it even more successful and keep even more people out of prison. private sector kind of inserting itself to carve out some of the money for profit. I mean, that's money that's going to these Goldman Sachs executives and people like that who don't really need it, instead of helping these young offenders who could really benefit from this sort of investment by the state in their welfare and well-being. So yeah, I mean, it just that's the issue that I have with that approach to this sort of data introduction with these things and measuring these programs, is why introduce the private sector? Just because the private sector has done these things doesn't mean that the private sector has to be involved at, you know, in every angle, or that everything has to be compared. Every time there's a profit motive in these public functions, that just really concerns me, because the reason that they were made public functions in the first place was because they weren't profitable for some reason. Again, it's important to get as much out of each dollar invested in these programs, but they're not necessarily meant to be money makers, and that's a bit of a problem. The other thing, just to close out this segment, the other thing that I've thought of a lot, and you mentioned this with regard to No Child Left Behind, and we had talked a number of weeks ago about the problems with the education system in this country, which are many, and it's a complex problem. A lot of these programs, whether they're education related or anything else, they've been very severely underfunded for many years. Especially a lot of them were gutted during the Reagan administration, but they've kind of been slowly defunded by successive administrations and various Republican Congresses and Democrats not really caring enough about them. And so the question is, are these programs that when you measure them, if they're shown to be quote unquote not working, are they not working because they are genuinely ineffective, or are they not working because they don't have enough resources to do their job effectively and to make a real dent on the situation? And again, that gets into that issue of, we can't just introduce measurement systems alone in isolation. They have to be accompanied with some sort of political and policy debate about what we want from these programs and what we want as a country, the government to be doing, and what we want to be happening with our society.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
All right, well, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment.